right, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Apparently we have a difference between our clock in this courtroom and our robing room, so I apologize. We made you wait a few extra minutes. We have one case on our 9 o'clock docket. We will hear that, and then we will take a 5 or 10 minute recess to allow for the 10 o'clock panel and case. The first case is Hoppenstein Properties versus Bill Schrober. If the clerk will please announce counsel. All right, Mr. Siegel.
May it please the court, my name is Martin Siegel. I represent the appellant, Hoppenstein Properties, in this case. We believe the case can be resolved by resort to a simple principle of the law of mitigation. And that principle is, if you're a landlord and you have two tenants, one of them abandons the property and defaults, it isn't mitigation to move the other one into that tenant's property, because obviously you've left yourself a hole where the original tenant was, and you haven't reduced your losses. Any gain you might have achieved by doing that would be offset by the loss suffered when you have a hole remaining in the existing tenant's property. If we're right about that principle, then we believe the judgment below has to be reversed. This case originates from a commercial lease entered into between Hoppenstein Properties, Inc., the appellant, and the appellee, Mr. Schrober. It was about a 12,000-square-foot property. Mr. Schrober defaulted on that lease. Hoppenstein Properties brought suit. There was no dispute at the trial that there had been a default. The only issue at trial was the amount of damages. And the only defense offered by Schrober was a failure to mitigate defense. And that really boiled down to one thing, which is a proposed mitigation option suggested by Schrober at trial, a single one, which was moving this existing tenant that I made reference to a minute ago into the space vacated by Mr. Schrober. That existing tenant's name was Mr. Cook, and Hoppenstein Properties declined to make that move when it was suggested by Mr. Schrober and Mr. Cook together for three reasons. First, because it wouldn't have helped him any. It would have just left him with another spot in the shopping center to fill. He didn't think that would reduce his losses, and by definition, therefore, wouldn't be mitigation. Second, because Mr. Cook had some financial problems. And third, because Mr. Cook's business, which was a printing business, generated some odors that had already caused another existing tenant to complain of the smell, and had required Mr. Cook to move some of his operations off-site. So for those three reasons, Hoppenstein said no. He didn't believe it was mitigation. It was tried to the jury. The jury returned damages of $5,500, indicating that it had accepted the defense of failure to mitigate, because that amount of money correlates to just the unpaid rent before this option was suggested by Mr. Cook and Mr. Schrober to Hoppenstein. And at trial, Hoppenstein proved that its damages should have been approximately $107,000. That sum is arrived at. You can divide it roughly in half. About $51,000, $52,000 of it represented unpaid rent by Mr. Schrober on this lease for the two-year period between April of 07 and April of 09. The remainder of it was had to do with some modifications that Hoppenstein made to the property to suit another tenant who did eventually take over part of the space. That person put in a hookah bar, and that required some plumbing and some other modifications that cost approximately $57,000. We believe those are the damages suffered by Hoppenstein Properties, and that this court should reverse and render in that amount, because there is legally and factually insufficient evidence that Hoppenstein Properties failed to mitigate. Now, the first reason we believe that there was a failure, rather that the jury got it wrong, and that there is insufficient evidence legally and factually of this failure to mitigate defense, was because it simply isn't mitigation to have taken Mr. Cook and to have put him into Mr. Schrober's space. By definition, mitigation is a reduction in the plaintiff's loss, or reduction in their damages. This would not have reduced Hoppenstein's damages at all. It simply would have taken a tenant that was paying rent on one spot, moved him over to the spot that Mr. Schrober vacated, and left that tenant, Mr. Cook's original space, for Hoppenstein to fill. He would have been in exactly the same situation, would not have done any good for him, and that's what he explained to Mr. Cook when he told him that he wasn't going to rent it. Now, we've cited a number of cases for the proposition, the facts aren't exactly analogous, but for the proposition that a landlord in this situation, or really any party to a contract, this, obviously the mitigation principle isn't just in real estate law, it applies equally across the world of contracts, a party that otherwise has a duty to mitigate does not have an obligation to suffer loss on their own or to expend their own personal funds or to take on any risk in mitigating. And that's exactly what Hoppenstein was being asked to do. He was being asked to take an existing tenant from one spot, move him over, and not ameliorate his loss in any way. By definition, that is not mitigation, and the jury could not have based a damages award on it, which is what it evidently did in this case. Now, there were some responses to that in the appellee's brief that I want to address. First, the appellee mentioned that, Mr. Cook, the person they wanted to move into Schober Space, eventually defaulted on his own lease and had to abandon his property. And so they say, well, see, therefore, if you'd moved him into Schober Space, at least you could have kept one tenant. As it was, he ended up with both spots empty. But that fact is simply irrelevant to whether or not it would have mitigated Hoppenstein's loss to move him into, to move Cook into Schober's space. The fact that down the line, later on, Mr. Cook proved unable to pay his own rent doesn't mean that at an earlier time it would have mitigated Hoppenstein's loss to put him into Schober's space. The only relevant question in this case is whether or not moving tenants around in the same shopping center that way really mitigates your loss, amounts to mitigation by definition, and clearly it doesn't. Ultimately, because Cook, you know, couldn't satisfy his obligations, doesn't mean anything about whether or not it was proper mitigation to have moved him into Schober's space.
At the time, was it the tenant next door to Cook complaining about odors from Cook's printing business?
Yes, the tenant next door to Cook was a bingo parlor. Very shortly after Cook moved in and began printing his signs, that person complained to Hoppenstein Properties. And so eventually Cook had to move his operations off-site, and he that was acknowledged by their counsel in closing argument. There wasn't really a factual dispute about whether odors really were being generated. He admitted in closing argument that, forget what the phrase was, but something along the lines of they probably smelled something. So that's why Cook had to move off-site. And that was, as I'll discuss in a moment, that was one of the other reasons that Hoppenstein Properties didn't want to just move him to another spot in this same center. It wouldn't make any sense to start down the road with a tenant that's producing odors just in a different spot. I mean, presumably his new neighbors would complain just like his old ones had. Now, another thing mentioned back on our first point of whether or not this could ever be mitigation in this situation where you have two tenants that you're just shuffling around. Another response that was made by Schober in their appeal, their appellee's brief, was that eventually Hoppenstein Properties got a judgment against Cook for his own default. But again, that fact is irrelevant. It doesn't matter that a judgment was eventually obtained by Hoppenstein against Cook. It doesn't have any bearing legally on whether or not it would have been proper mitigation to move Cook into Schober's space. And in fact, as it happens, that judgment has never been paid. And if you look at the record, when Mr. Cook was asked about it at trial, he said he didn't have the money to pay it and, in fact, seemed to indicate that he didn't think he owed it. So it doesn't – I don't know if the point by Schober was that, well, you know, they have that judgment, and so that kind of mitigates over there, and then they could have moved Schober into Cook space, and that would have mitigated – sorry, they could have moved Cook into Schober space, and that would have been mitigation there. But that doesn't really add up. They couldn't have obtained the judgment against Cook, even if they, you know, if they had agreed to move him into Schober's space. And the fact that they later did, because Cook couldn't pay his own rent, doesn't mean that it would have been mitigating to move Cook into Schober's space at an earlier time. Now, a third point that they make in their brief is that actually, they say, Cook's rent was lower than Schober's, not higher. And so, therefore, if you've moved Cook into Schober space, it would have been mitigating because he would have been paying some higher rent. A couple of things about that. The record is actually quite clear that Cook's rent was higher than Schober's and not lower. And, of course, the result of that is that moving Cook into Schober space and having him pay a lower rent not only wouldn't have been mitigation, it would have been a further loss for Hoppenstein Properties. The dispute centers around an amendment to Cook's lease. It's the last page in our appendix. And that amendment to the lease clearly obligates Cook to pay an additional, I think it was $524 on his rent. And when you add that up, it means that he overall, at all times during this two-year period, paid higher rent than Schober did. Now, Schober argues that Cook testified at trial that actually the plan was for him to sublease that to somebody else, and he wasn't going to be obligated for that. But there's no evidence in the record that that arrangement ever came to fruition. In fact, Mr. Cook testified that he never heard any more about it after he first brought it up. And regardless of how he might have gotten the money for that, his rent was what it was. It was defined by the contracts, and the contracts clearly made him liable as the primary lessor for that additional amount. And so the upshot of all of that is that Cook's rent was higher than Schober's, not lower. Even if we're wrong about that, even if factually this court looks at it and decides, well, yeah, okay, there's evidence in the record that suggests Cook's rent was lower, and so therefore moving him over, as Schober and Cook proposed, would have saved Hoppenstein a little money, it's very modest, and we have the figures in our brief. It adds up to about $4,000 that it would have saved Hoppenstein if he had accepted this proposal. And so if that's true, then all it means is this court, when reversing and rendering, should reduce the amount that we've proposed in our brief by that sum, and we have the exact figures in our papers. It doesn't really mean very much, because basically their rents were comparable, which is why it would never have made any sense to choose this as a mitigation option. They were paying more or less the same rent, so why would you just move them over here when you're still going to have to find a new tenant over there? We concede there might be some circumstances where that would be mitigation. If it was easier, for example, to rent the existing and remaining tenant space, maybe, than the guy who had defaulted, then maybe you would say, well, that is mitigating because you move him into the one that's harder to rent, and now it's easier to rent this one over here. The landlord should do that. But there's no evidence in the record of that, and that wasn't the argument made at trial. It's just a game of musical chairs that wouldn't have suited Hoppenstein in any way.
But go ahead.
Well, my question was going to be, why wasn't it for the jury to look at these circumstances and determine whether it was objectively unreasonable?
Well, the jury did something like that, clearly. The jury seems to have accepted that argument, but by definition, it can't be mitigating. I mean, as a matter of law, it has to save Hoppenstein Properties money to enter into this arrangement that was proposed at trial as the only mitigation option that Hoppenstein was derelict for not accepting. And just as a matter of law, by definition, it's not going to save him money. I don't know why the jury seized on it and accepted that, but it can't possibly amount to legally sufficient evidence if we can look at these facts and conclude that Hoppenstein still would have had Cook space to rent. He would have been in exactly the same situation.
So your position is that they needed to show, or I guess really you would have to show, that there was no viable other lease available, in other words, other tenant.
Well, it was their burden at all times. This is a failure to mitigate is an affirmative defense. So what they had to show at trial was that we had failed to mitigate, and they had a burden. They had to carry that burden to show we did something in failing to mitigate. And I'm sure, as the court knows, usually what that means is, you don't talk to prospective tenants, you don't put signs out, you don't list the property. All those things were done by Hoppenstein Properties. There's no complaint about any of that. The sole failure, the sole way that they tried to carry their burden and show Hoppenstein failed to mitigate, was saying you had to take this guy. Schober defaults, a month or so goes by. Schober and Cook were friends, so they talk to each other, and they both say, hey, this would be a great solution. Of course, it would be for Schober and Cook. It's great for them. It doesn't do anything for Hoppenstein. It's great for them. They go to Hoppenstein and say, we have the answer. Just let Cook move over here. That's all that was presented at trial to carry their burden. And just as a matter of law, that can't be mitigation because it doesn't reduce his damages.
But so you do agree that a tenant could show a failure to mitigate if they put on other evidence, such as failure to put out signs?
Oh, sure.
Failure to,
oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And in that case, there obviously might not be another tenant coming in.
Well,
in other words, if you don't advertise it,
sure.
Perhaps.
Sure. No, that's a standard failure to mitigate case in the real estate setting, which is the landlord, a tenant's moved out, landlord just does nothing, sits around,
right,
and tries to collect the rent. And
Mr. Siegel.
Yes, Your Honor.
On page 7 of your brief, you cite that the cost of renovation and remodeling of the 3,500 square feet that was leased to Nelson and Cram was $54,869.88.
Yes, Your Honor.
Wasn't that renovation to make the space suitable for that tenant built into the lease price that the tenant was going to pay. In other words, didn't the lease, monthly lease payments include a recovery of the landlord for the cost of the renovation?
I'm not, the monthly lease payments for the incoming new tenant or the monthly lease?
Yes, for the new tenant.
I don't know. I don't know that the record reflects that. The new tenant was going to come in and they were going to pay what they were going to pay. I don't know that.
Well, the lease for the new tenant was Exhibit 18 in the trial, so it's in evidence. And so your evidence concerning the checks that were written for payment of the renovation was in the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
My only question is whether or not the structuring of the lease for the new tenant included a recoupment of the landlord of the amount of money that it took to remodel.
Your Honor, I have to confess, I don't know if there's a specific mention of that in the lease for the new tenant. Regardless of that, I think we can assume whatever cost was charged to the new tenant, I'm certain a landlord in that situation would always want to recoup, you know, if he could, would want to get the highest price he could, and I assume that would try to include recoupment of any costs he made to modify. I don't think that changes the legal obligation that Schober has, because in the previous contract, before that one ever existed, between Schober and Hoppenstein, Schober specifically committed to pay for remodeling, renovation, and other changes. In fact, the modifier reasonable isn't even in that lease. It just says you're going to pay for remodeling and renovation for if you default, and we have to make changes for a future tenant. So Schober was contractually committed to that, and I don't believe they've made the argument that we're let out of that because now there's a new tenant coming in to pay Hoppenstein. Beyond even that contractual obligation that Schober had, there, of course, is just the general principle in the common law of mitigation that a landlord is permitted to make some reasonable changes in order to re-let the space.
Right. Now, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, just to continue on that point, that is, of course, an argument made by Schober. I think not exactly Your Honor's point, but the point that the jury must have concluded these costs were excessive, and so that's part of why they awarded what they awarded. A couple of responses. First of all, there's no evidence in the record that the costs were excessive in the sense that, you know, the contractors were charging too much or they really didn't need to put this in or that in order to retrofit the space for a bar. There's no evidence of that at all in the record. The only evidence was the testimony from Mr. Hoppenstein and, as Your Honor points out, the actual bills.
So there was some evidence, though, in the record that the use of the tenant space was changing, and some
yes.
of those changes likely did require some of the costs that was incurred.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no doubt that a new tenant was coming in, they were going to use part of it, I think it was 3,500 square feet or something, for a different use. And there's no dispute that they had to make some changes. I think Schober just says, well, look, that was, you know, added up to $57,000. Jury found that wasn't, must have necessarily found that that wasn't reasonable, but there's no evidence in the record that it was not needed or that they were doing things that you wouldn't need to do to change the space. But beyond that, even if the court could conclude that that's what the jury necessarily thought, regardless of that, there's some amount of renovation that clearly is allowed that would be reasonable, and all that means is this court ought to remand for another trial on damages and let that be handled by a second jury. Now, I want to cover, there were a couple of other reasons why Hoppenstein declined to rent this space to Schober, aside from the fact that it, by definition, wasn't going to be mitigation. First was the financial condition of Mr. Cook. Mr. Cook testified at trial that he was in a precarious financial situation for a number of reasons. He'd had a robbery, and he explained at trial that robbery left him, quote, unable to recover. Another reason was that he depended for some of his business on the construction industry, and so he testified that, you know, construction has been down. I guess some of the signs he printed were for people in that world. And that was hurting his business. He had paid a couple of times in early 07. He'd given checks to Hoppenstein for rent. They'd come back with notations on them saying the account was closed. And so clearly Mr. Cook was having financial troubles, and Hoppenstein concluded, well, why would I start over with this tenant in a different spot with roughly equivalent rent? It just didn't make any sense. The law is perfectly clear that in fulfilling your duty to mitigate, you do not have to take on financial risk. That's the Austin Realty Company case, the Hill Country Realty case. And that's what this would have been for Hoppenstein. Schober responds that, well, you know, Cook testified he would have had some more walk-in traffic if he was closer to the street, and he would have maybe done better if his printing operations were back in that location. Fine, Maybe that's true, and maybe the jury was allowed to believe that. Well, there was no evidence that that would have been sufficient to make him something other than a risky tenant. There's no evidence that he would have then been able to meet his rent, that it would have done enough for him. He just said, well, I think I could have, you know, maybe done a little better. Clearly, it was objectively reasonable for Hoppenstein to not continue on with this risky tenant. The second reason had to do with the odor, which we've talked about a little bit in response to Your Honor's question. Given that in one corner of the shopping center, Cook's properties had annoyed existing other tenants and forced him to change his operations, again, it would be a risk for Hoppenstein to install him in a different part of the place when we can presume that he would have continued on his operations, and there was no evidence in the record that he would not have just produced the same odors and possibly annoyed some of his new neighbors, one of which was a church. Now, Schober testified that I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Mr. Siegel, your time is up.
Thank you, Your
Honor. We went over a little bit.
Thank you very much.
Rose, if you'll give Mr. Rogers an additional minute, please.
May it please the court. My name is Bruce Rogers. I'm with the Brown Dean firm here in Fort Worth. And I am ably assisted by Jennifer Willingham, one of the associates with my firm, who did the bulk of the brief writing. She deserves the credit. She's also been prompting me with good arguments. This is not a case about whether it is mitigation to shuffle a tenant from one space into another, all things being equal. It wasn't that at all. What we have are two very different spaces, one next to a bingo parlor, one very large, with one end of it completely remote to the church at the far end, as Mr. Cook testified, a football field away. So this issue of smell becomes a judgment call. And what Mr. Hoppenstein elected to do was, rather than, for example, try, he just said no. And you'll see it in our brief, you'll see it in the record. What Mr. Hoppenstein told Mr. Cook was the reason why he wasn't going to rent to Cook was because then he thought he was going to lose his opportunity to go after Mr. Schober. That's what the jury heard. And that lays the foundation for an assessment of whether, A, Mr. Hoppenstein was being truthful in explaining his reasons for not renting, and B, whether those reasons really are valid.
Mr. Rogers, why isn't it a business choice to make the decision whether to accept a tenant who's in Mr. Cook's situation, as opposed to proceeding under the contract of lease and seeking the damages that are there from the contract's breach? Why isn't that a business choice that would not necessarily be an area of evidence that would support the jury verdict?
Your Honor, it's an area of business choice, but the business choice is tempered by the law that requires the landlord to take reasonable steps to mitigate. What the jury heard was evidence that what Mr. Hoppenstein did was not reasonable. I mean, when you look at the global situation there, we have Cook, whose business is struggling in that location. And he testified at length about how dividing his business, having to move his printing operation to his garage, and then deal with the city trying to get him to stop, you know, operating a business out of his garage, all and the loss of efficiency, the loss of control over his employees, the increase in mistakes in printing, all that was hurting his business. He believed, and what he told the jury, was that if he moved the business into one location, if he could have moved it into Schober's place, into the Schober space that had been vacated, A, he would have been far enough from the church not to bother them, and B, it would have allowed him to control his operations and run profitably. I mean, he had been running that business for many years, that was his testimony, and he was still operating his business at the time of trial. The man knows how to do it, to run that business. But because he had this divided operation, he was financially struggling. Mr. Hoppenstein reasonably could have shifted Mr. Cook into the Schober space. It wouldn't have, this argument that it would have exposed him to more risk because, you know, Cook was a dubious tenant. Okay, that makes sense when it's a new tenant. I mean, what's this guy's credit history? Does he pay his rent on time? That's when you decide if you're going to rent to him. He was already a tenant. That risk would not have changed, I mean, not at all. That's not a reason to deny moving that tenant from one space to another. It wouldn't have cost anything for Hoppenstein to move Cook into the space because Cook testified he would have taken it as is. He didn't need any changes made.
But isn't the information and testimony regarding Mr. Cook's situation more relevant to his potentially future lawsuit with Hoppenstein?
Well,
I mean,
as far as
their duty to mitigate.
Well, I don't know that a landlord has a duty to a current tenant. I don't think Mr. Hoppenstein breached a duty to Cook by failing to allow him to move into that space, into the Schober space. But what that did was push this, what's turned out to be a huge loss, onto Schober, when by allowing Cook to move in, for example, then, A, there's the issue of how much was Cook paying for rent for spaces 410, 411 that were the space he was in versus the Schober space. And it's in the record, the rent for the 410, 411 space that Cook would have vacated is less than Schober's rent. So, okay, there's a few hundred dollars there. But that's your starting point. Then you look at what is the risk to Cook or to Hoppenstein if Cook stinks up the place. Well, he goes back to exactly where he was prior. He tells him, sorry, you can't print in here. But maybe that's not what's going to happen. And he never allowed that opportunity. What he did, he gave his reason. We're not letting you testify because, or we're not letting you move in there because we want to be able to sue Mr. Schober. And then he came up with all these other reasons that are not objectively reasonable. The additional risk for the financial unsteadiness of Mr. Cook's business, irrelevant. He's exposed to that risk either way. The risk that the smell will bother the adjacent tenant, irrelevant, because all he has to do is tell Cook to quit it. He already did that once. So then it comes down to the real issue here is, and this was a question for the jury, would moving Cook into Schober's space have been sufficient to save Cook's business? Because that's really where this case turns. If that would have saved Cook's business and allowed him to stay in his space, then Cook would have been paying the rent that Schober would have been paying. Now, how would Mr. Hoppenstein have stood? Well, okay. He would have been out a couple of months' rent up front, and he would have been out for the amount of time that the Cook space stood vacant until it was rented out. Well, Mr. Hoppenstein's already been paid for that. He's got a judgment against Mr. Cook for that. So what we have here is an attempt to recover that again, it appears to me. The relevance of the judgment against Mr. Cook isn't to do with the reasonableness of the action, it's to do with the measure of the damages. That's where that kicks in. And so when the jury looked at the facts and they saw that Cook could have moved in there, they apparently believed that that would have saved Cook's business, and that's their job to decide. They're the fact finders. Then if Cook's business is saved, then the loss to Mr. Hoppenstein isn't $107,000. It's a property that he would have rented with no additional investment, and then a recovery, potentially a recovery against Schober for lost rents that he's already had against Cook. Now let's talk about the improvements to the hookah bar for just a second, because Your Honor touched on a real sensitive issue there, and the jury noticed that too. On the order of $55,000 was spent on the improvements for the hookah bar. The rents, the lease is there in front of you, and the rents don't add up to that. It's a two-year lease, and I think it added up to, what, $45,000. So there's a shortfall there. Now, the argument is that we heard at trial was, oh, well, but they would have released to, they thought they would have released to the hookah bar. Yeah, maybe the alternative is they saw someone that they thought they had a hook into because of that lease, and they could recover on the improvements against old Schober because they left that space sitting vacant. The other side of it is, how hard is it to rent the two spaces? Well, the judgment against Mr. Cook is on the order of $20,000 versus this one where they're looking for something like $50,000 for lost rents.
Mr. Rogers.
Yes, sir.
There wasn't a judgment against Mr. Cook at the time of trial, was there?
Yes, there was, and that was put into evidence before the jury.
All right, but in terms of Mr. Cook's liabilities, how can that be a mitigating factor for Mr. Schober on his breach of his own lease contract? In other words, you still got an empty space. If you've got a judgment, you may have something you might collect if you've got a solvent judgment debtor to get after. But what about fact that the space is empty and still empty at the time of trial.
Where that comes in, Your Honor, is on the issue of measure. The reasonableness of Hoppenstein's refusal to rent to Cook, you have to assess from other factors. Would it have saved the business? Was he exposed to additional financial risk? Was he exposed to additional odor risk? And the latter two are no, and the jury decided that it would have saved Cook's business. So then the jury gets to look at the totality now of where are these people standing. At the time, if Cook had been rented the space, if he'd moved into Schober's space, then Hoppenstein could have turned right around and sued Schober for whatever the loss of rent was, because that's his expense in order to perform that mitigation.
I'm just having a lot of trouble with all of the focus on Mr. Cook on a breach of contract by your client. So, and what we're doing is focusing on what Cook could have done, might have done, should have done, and maybe could have done in the future if we put all that hypothetical together, without there being anything other than still an empty space, one empty space being traded for another empty space. To me, if you've got two empty spaces, the landlord is I don't see how he's mitigating his damages in any way.
Well, what we have, though, instead of it being an empty space where Mr. Schober was versus an empty space where Mr. Cook was, we have Mr. Cook in a business that's failing because he's in his original space, who could have saved his business by moving into the new space, and because he didn't move in, he had to move out.
Well,
it was killing his business.
I understand that argument, but there's also testimony in the record that there was a robbery and that the construction business was down.
Mm-hmm.
Both
yes,
of those factors are all in front of the jury, and they could legally have looked upon those things, but all I'm saying is there just seems to be a whole lot of this focus on Mr. Cook as opposed to focus on Mr. Schober. Perhaps there might have been mitigation of damages to Schober, but I don't see how there were mitigation of damages to Hoppenstein.
Schober still would have been liable for the shortfall in rents. With Cook moving into Schober's old space, then that rent is covered. But in order to cover that rent, Mr. Hoppenstein would have incurred the loss of Cook, where Cook was paying. Agreed?
Right.
Okay. Now, that's the measure. So what we have is a two-month vacancy up front, and then how long was Cook out? Well, the measure of how long Cook was out is the amount of damages that Hoppenstein got in his judgment against Cook. And if he gets that money now against Schober, he's getting it twice. The court should not be awarding him double damages. Let him go after two people and get a judgment against both of them for that same shortfall. That's where
two Cook's separate lease contracts and two separate shortfalls, and I don't see why there should be only one recovery for those two breaches of contract.
First issue is, was it reasonable to refuse to rent to Cook? And as I've explained to the court, I believe the jury reasonably concluded that it was unreasonable because there would have been no additional exposure of risk for smell or financial, and because then they believed Cook's business would have been saved and he would have been able to pay that rent. And so then they're left with, well, now, okay, if they were unreasonable, what is the correct measure of the damages? It doesn't include the $55,000 to fix the space up to rent off to a hookah bar for less than the actual amount spent. And what it reasonably would include is what was the lost rent that was incurred before they rented Cook's space. And we know that. It's the $20,000 that Cook already owes. Hoppenstein's already recovered for that. I mean, if anything, Cook and Schober ought to be arm wrestling over who pays that $20,000. That's up to them. So where we end up here is this issue of will it save the business? Because that really is the key. Mr. Hoppenstein didn't give it a chance to find out, and he could have done that for virtually no exposure. It doesn't cost him anything for a tenant to move his affairs from one location to another. The tenant pays for the move. It doesn't cost the landlord anything if there's a smell, to tell the tenant to quit making the smell. He's already done it once. And Mr. Hoppenstein was already exposed to the financial risk of that tenant. So incurring additional financial risk wasn't an issue. He wouldn't have been.
And were there any objections at trial regarding this further testimony on Cook's rather precarious situation?
In terms of my objection to Mr. Cook's financial position being put before the jury?
No, I would have thought perhaps maybe Hoppenstein had raised objections to going into this type of evidence at trial.
No,
and
he did
were
not.
There, okay.
His lawyer elicited the testimony.
Okay.
Can you comment briefly on the question about submission of the defense of mitigation of damages and the
Thank you.
Proof?
Yes. The question was submitted exactly as it appears in the pattern jury charge. And the judge reasonably relied upon what was in the pattern jury charge. And we're guided that provided we don't go to Baylor, we don't necessarily have to rewrite the jury charge each time we get in front of a court. But the other side of that is I think that was waived, and that's in our brief. Because when you search through the record, there was no written presentation of the instruction that the plaintiff wanted. And it's my understanding that that waives the point of error, and apparently that's right because I didn't see it in the reply brief, and there was no address of that issue previously. But even if I'm wrong that it wasn't waived, we followed the pattern jury charge. Well, I just took it right out of the book and handed it to the court, and he was inclined to go with what we're told is an appropriate instruction on mitigation.
So your prayer as far as treatment of the case is a straight affirmance, is that correct?
Affirmance, and we'd like the cost of the appeal.
All
right. If there are no other questions, thank you.
I don't believe so. Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Mr. Siegel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
First, I want to address the argument that the jury was told that Hoppenstein had a conversation with Cook where Hoppenstein said to Cook, well, we're not going to rent to you because I want to go after Mr. Schober. If moving Cook into Schober space is not mitigation because it's just still going to leave a hole over here, then Hoppenstein's motive is entirely irrelevant. We concede that was told to the jury and the jury could have believed that, but it doesn't matter why Hoppenstein did what he did because it still isn't mitigation. It just doesn't do Hoppenstein any good, and so whatever he was thinking in his mind about later I'm going to sue Schober or I'm not is irrelevant to whether it is or is not mitigation. If Mr. Cook is not a suitable tenant because of his financial problems and because of his odor problems, then, Hoppenstein had every right to do exactly as he did, which is to proceed in the contract and sue Mr. Schober. He had a duty to rent to a suitable tenant. That's the basic duty of mitigation. But as it happens, Cook was not suitable because it wouldn't reduce his damages and because he had his other issues. And so then Hoppenstein could sue Mr. Schober, and that's what he did. The comment is irrelevant.
But apparently isn't there a conflict in the record as to the amount of revenue on the Cook lease? In other words, as to whether it would really reduce damages or not. It sounds like you all both have different positions on
We have different positions. I don't think the record is actually unclear at all. The record,
okay.
If you look at the lease, this is just resolved by looking at Cook's lease, and you add up the figures in Cook's lease. There was an amendment to Cook's lease. You add the amendment to the original amount, okay. And it's over what Schober had to pay. The conflict that they've created is by saying Cook testified that he was going to sublet that, and so therefore he wasn't really responsible for it. Cook then went on to say that never materialized, or what he really said is I never heard more about it. And regardless, the lease is the lease. He had an obligation to pay that.
Okay.
And anyway, it's only a $4,000 difference.
Okay.
Their rents were roughly comparable. Now, the second thing I want to address is the argument that we just heard from Mr. Schober's lawyer. He basically seems to be saying that if we move Cook into Schober space, he concedes that that would leave a hole over here in Cook space. And then he seems to be saying, well, Schober, that's Schober's damages. Schober would then be responsible for paying what Cook was supposed to pay because he acknowledges there'd be a hole there, and he's just saying, well, that's how you should measure the damages that Schober pays. Well, first of all, the one, as Justice Meyer points out, has nothing to do with the other. Your Honor asked whether or not at trial there was evidence introduced of this judgment. That's really not the correct time. The correct time is at when Mr. Hoppenstein was presented with this mitigation option. He didn't have a judgment against Cook. Cook was an existing tenant. It was only later that Cook proved unable to pay that rent and drifted away and abandoned his property. And then sometime much later after that, a suit was brought and a judgment was obtained, which, by the way, has never been paid. He keeps saying, well, it'd be double recovery for Hoppenstein. It was never paid. But regardless of that, Hoppenstein had to make a decision at the time this option was presented to him. And when it was presented to him, Cook was an existing tenant, albeit with some difficulties. But he wasn't going to say to himself, well, yeah, if Cook moves over here, and then I'll get Schober to pay the rent over here, and if that doesn't work, I'll sue Cook for it. None of that makes any sense. It was months later that the judgment was obtained. And by the way, even if he's right, even if all that's correct, then what he's saying is, well, that's $20,000, which was the judgment against Cook, off the balance. Well, that would still leave $80,000, a deficit that Schober would be responsible for if you accept this notion that Schober now is going to be paying Cook's rent, and so the judgment against Cook is kind of an offset against that. I mean, none of that, I think, is real mitigation, but even if you bought that, then there's still an $80,000 deficit that Cook would be responsible, or rather Schober would be responsible for paying. The last point I want to make is that the argument was made that the jury must have decided that moving Cook into Schober's space would have saved Cook's business. There simply is no evidence in the record of that. What there is evidence in the record of is Mr. Cook saying, I think I would have got more customers if I'd had the walk-in, you know, the place closer to the street, and I think I wouldn't have had an odor problem because there was greater distance between me and the nearby tenant. Fair enough, even if the jury believed that, he didn't complete the circle. There needed to be evidence from somebody, you know, an expert or even Mr. Cook's being able to lay it out, that that would have saved his business and that would have enabled him to continue operating in this new space. There was no such evidence. There was just Mr. Cook's subjective hope that if he'd gotten a new location, you know, maybe his business would have improved. Absent that evidence, it was not Mr. Hoppenstein's job to take on the risk. The way it was put in argument was, well, give him a chance. You know, he never got the opportunity to move into this new space and show that it would have worked. That's not how mitigation works. The law is quite clear that you only have to take, you don't have to take any willing tenant, you have to take a suitable tenant, one that's suitable to the space. And the argument, you know, was Mr. Schober's counsel said, well, you know, maybe that applies if you have a new tenant, but not an existing tenant. On the contrary, the rule's even more applicable with an existing tenant because this is an existing tenant that was already beginning to have financial problems and had already had the odor problem. He'd proved himself unsuitable already. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Thank you.